Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, what are the psychological challenges for children and young people amidst this time of COVID-19? Contributing host Lillian Ng speaks with Hiren Tabru and Melanie Woodfield about the ways that families can support their children and adolescents. And first, Brazil is the largest country in South America with the highest GDP, a huge population, large urban centers, and a deep divide between rich and poor. Its response to the coronavirus has implications not only for the country itself, but also for the region and the world. Contributing host Doug Becker examines the policies and actions of the Bolsonaro regime, the complexities of Brazilian federalism, and the state of the nation in the pandemic.
Brazil is the largest nation in South America with the highest GDP, high rates of urbanization, and deep divisions between rich and poor. It also has a complex federalist government structure not that dissimilar to the United States. In today's show, we will examine how the Brazilian government has been confronting the COVID-19 pandemic. We will focus on the breadth of the threat, the relationship between the federal government in Brasilia and the states, and a report card on the policies of Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro. Our guest today is Erica Resende, Assistant Professor of International Relations and Security Studies at the Brazilian War College in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. She is co-editor of Memory and Trauma in International Relations, Theories, Cases, and Debates, and Crisis and Change in Post-Cold War Global Politics. So Erica, first, how significant has the COVID-19 pandemic been in Brazil?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to note that Brazil had been already struggling through both an economic crisis and a political one. And when the COVID pandemic came up, I think it's very safe to say that once again, we can see, we have to acknowledge how even such a grave problem as a pandemic is limited to the logics of politics. Because the coronavirus crisis is being subjected to the logic of politics. And specifically here in Brazil, the politics of populism. How populism is looking to the current situation, you could actually understand, and it points out very interesting developments where you can pinpoint how much of the case that is able to do to make an argument for Bolsonaro as a populist leader. And so you can see very well being played the anti-elitist, anti-pluralist approach to populism. You could also see how something as meaningful and grave and severe as the current pandemic is being treated and framed as only one aspect of something that is happening, a crisis, but still subjected to the logics of we versus them, of antagonism, of polarization within Brazil politics.
In discussing Brazilian politics, at this point, there's no figure in Brazil that is more significant, that casts a larger shadow over political decisions made than the president, Jair Bolsonaro. Can you give us a bit of a description? You referenced that he's populist. What exactly is populism meant? And can you describe, prior to the pandemic, what his presidency has been like?
Jair Bolsonaro got elected in late 2018 until he came into office January 1st, 2019. His election is easily explained more from circumstantial structures and problems emerging from the so-called car wash procedures. It's what happened when the presidency of both Lula, President Lula da Silva, and Dilma Rousseff was impeached. And all the federal investigations that had to do with corruption and money being distributed to congressmen to give support to both Lula and Dilma political agenda. So the shock of the revelations, the trials that prolonged for almost 1.5 years, that left a very stark, a very bad taste for Brazilian people. So the political campaign for presidency was pretty much centered on a vote against the PT party, the Labor Party, which had traditionally been in opposition in Brazil, but came into power and was able to elect two terms for Lula, 1.5 terms for Dilma. So it was a reaction or a backslash against that was perceived as a very progressive agenda. At the same time, a little bit because of the 2008 economic crisis that originated in the US and Europe, but with a backslash and took a little while to arrive in Brazil. And so starting 2010-11, things in Brazilian economy went south. So it was a mix of resentment and the shocking news and the trauma for PT that always had a very ethical, high ethical and progressive agenda. How could they been meddled with this such a big scandalous corruption affair? And also lots of resentment from conservative groups from the right that traditionally have been a little more mute in Brazil. But all of a sudden, through social media like Facebook, WhatsApp, and Instagram, all that came out with a vengeance. So there was some way, and in a way you could explain the election of Jair Bolsonaro as him previously someone that had not occupied, the central stage in Brazilian federal politics. But all of a sudden, he began to represent all that anger, resentment that came out very strongly against anything that could be associated with the left. So Bolsonaro was elected, but the support, and I have to say this, the Brazilian national elections of 2018 have a very high no turn up in the booths. So about 20% of people did not show up, or if they did show, and they canceled their vote. So those two factors, specific of that time of resentment and challenging through Bolsonaro, as well as this high, allowed Bolsonaro to be elected. He was elected from a very weak party. Brazil has a plural political party system. His political party was what we in political science, we call it party for hire. If you have money that you want to put in or someone that in the last 2 years became popular, you will be sought after by those small political parties. So a political party.
And that's actually fairly common for Brazil, right? That the left has a pretty well-entrenched political party, the PT or the Labor Party, but most Brazilian political parties are actually fairly weak.
Yeah, fairly weak, with no specific agenda or identity, very ideologically weak, empty. So his political party, once he got elected, he did not have majority in the houses. PT still holds the majority in Congress, for example. So since he came into the office, he has been very aggressive towards what he calls old politics or traditional politics, refusing to negotiate with Congress and the Senate, refusing to play for, so to speak, the democratic game of bargaining and trying to reach consensus. So a very aggressive, more like belligerent attitude regarding the democratic institutions like the Supreme Court, the judiciary branch, any institutions that traditionally would hold the presidency or anyone from the branches accountable. And also the way to be able to characterize Bolsonaro as a populist leader, populist has been in has come back with a vengeance, not only to Brazilian politics, but all over. You have examples of that, both from the right and from the left. Be in Europe, very traditional democratic, liberal democracies, as well as more late democracies models. So even if you look into, there are like four or five different definitions of populism, but if you take those characteristics and look into Bolsonaro's case, you will easily make the argument and he is fulfilling the criteria. The one that I like to apply in his case is the idea of a populist leader presenting himself as the sole and unique representative of the people's will, as only himself is the true representative, and being able to understand what does the people needs and express and make those needs and turn into reality. Also, all the time, in order for the populist regime to maintain or to gain and maintain support, engaging in a constant conflict-driven discourse, and a discourse that it's against institutions, against democracy itself, against anything or anyone that, any actor that could be understood as representative of the elites. Represents so in this package of the elites that would be against the will of the people. The elites being scientists, politicians, economic elites, economic agents. So that explains a lot of how very aggressively has been against scientists that are now articulating Brazilian or trying to articulate and put forth Brazilian policy to fight the COVID. And so, also very anti-pluralist. So he has a public discourse of against LGBT rights, against African Brazilians, against any kind of minority, and very white, Christian, male, patriarchal, heterosexual stances, and condemning any kind of minority.
So you're describing kind of a personalistic politics, some antipathy towards science, some unwillingness to compromise, and some deep divisions within the different branches of government. And the view from up north here in the United States, there is certainly some similarities.
Lots.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. Our guest today is Erica Resende of the Brazilian War College. So at this point, let's talk about the pandemic. How bad has it been in Brazil? Is Brazil suffering the number of cases and the number of fatalities that other countries, that when we usually think of the countries that have been hit the hardest, obviously the United States and Italy and China, et cetera. Should Brazil be on that list of countries that have been hit particularly hard?
We don't know. And the reasons we don't know, because data is very, very weak. And when I say data, Brazil has been suffering a problem, acute problem of lack of mass testing. So our numbers are not solid. Our numbers are not credible. So whenever the Minister of Health goes into every day, it used to be, the Minister of Health is releasing numbers day by day, you know, how many more infected people in which cities, how many deaths in the last 24 hours and all that. But those numbers, they surely suffer from sub-notification. That is, there are not enough tests to actually be able to tell how many deaths are due to COVID, how many people are actually infected. So you have experts saying that the official numbers should be multiplied by 10, by 12, by 15, or even 50. So it's anyone's guess. But one thing that I want to make also clear for the audience, and especially an American audience, that unlike the U.S., and I think, and also it's interesting to try to establish a comparison, but with some care. We are a continental country as well as the U.S. We have a federal system as well as the U.S. There's the current, so to speak, similarities, as you mentioned, between Trump and Bolsonaro, yes. But we have one thing that we should try to put in at center stage. Unlike the U.S., we have a universal healthcare system. This universal healthcare system, it's very alike the ones you find in Europe, especially NHS in the U.K., so it means that whether you are employed or not, if you're young or old, if you're black or white, from the north or the south, no matter, because you're a citizen, you are entitled to public health care. And our healthcare system is the one that exists of over 60 years or so. So it's nothing new. It has always been there since the 1930s and perfected in the 50s. It sustained the military rule, came back renewed and with much more grasping and more capillar and more autonomy after our redemocratization. And it's this healthcare system where traditionally all kinds of national campaigns for vaccination, smallpox, and whenever people actually need, and it's because of this, it has a very deep web system that is able to penetrate to the farthest reaches of the country. It is the national public health service that is there now fighting the good fight. So it's a system that has most of intensive care units with the ventilators that are so much and now important. So today, even if you do have, I myself, for example, I have my own private health insurance coverage. But if I do get sick, if I do get infected, there's 70% chance that I'm going to be treated in the public system. Because the private hospitals, they lack the not only some of the infrastructure, as well as this kind of epidemiology is usually conducted in the public system.
Is Brazil under stay-at-home orders nationally? Are there certain states? Are there certain cities? And if or if not, you know, who's making the decision as to whether or not there's shelter-in-place types of orders across Brazil?
So now things are really interesting from a political science point of view, not for those who are actually getting sick. Bolsonaro, typically as a populist leader, is always trying to create crisis. And by the creation and the polarization, he's able to wake up and keep very politically active his supporters, especially on social media. So in a way, even before the pandemics, every once in a week or every 2 weeks, something happens in Brazil, that something that he says or something that he offends, and charges and with no proof or no evidence, something always happens that the polarization is always kept on. So it's an ongoing prolonged crisis, him against political parties or whoever is the enemy of the jour, of the day. So, and when the pandemics was announced by the World Health Organization, and it was in March 11, immediately, again, anti-science, this is nothing. That's the official policy, or more to say, the officially there was a lack of national policy. As a result, at subnational level, cities, municipalities, and states, those are the actors that began to work a response. So the first wave of responses were led by the governors of both Rio de Janeiro State and São Paulo State, mm-hmm. and then followed very close by other governors and some mayors of big cities, Rio, São Paulo, the big cities, and started mobilizing and working up plans of hospitals that were supposed to be the welcoming hub unit for those, where you should go, what you should do. So they lack the federal, so to speak, competence to shut down and decree quarantine, lockdown. But within their subnational competence and within the federal law, they were able, for example, to suspend trading business and shut down or try to slow down. Therefore, the first response was isolation at home, especially elderly, shutting down schools, shutting down non-essential businesses. All those initiatives were decided at state and city level. Almost immediately, Bolsonaro reacted. And from how it has been played out, his reaction was very stark and very directed towards the governors of Rio and São Paulo, whom Bolsonaro sees as potential rivals for the 2020 campaign for presidency. So his reaction was to downplay the virus, downplay COVID, try to reassert that those decisions are only able to be done by the federal government and not at the state level. A week later, the Supreme Court confirmed that both cities and states did have power to decide on isolation and social distancing and take any measures they saw fit. So the next step, what Bolsonaro did, was to take the polarization against his rivals more broadly. And the framing of the current pandemic response was, this is going to kill the economy. Mm-hmm. So one thing that's very interesting is how, which is very now similar to the U.S., the case in the Trump, is a discourse of placing a trade-off between lives and economy. Yeah, we're going to save a few lives, but we'll ruin the economy. There will be more people unemployed and blah, blah, blah. So in the last month and a half, we've been officially isolation by the states and practicing social distancing for about a little more than 45 days. And at the national level, this constant, this is going to hurt the economy. And almost daily, be it the governors or city officials, they organize a press conference to release the more recent data on deaths and how many intensive care units are available, what is the standard. And following that, immediately, Bolsonaro goes into Twitter or whatever and starts criticizing and downplaying the virus. And this reached almost in epic proportions when about 2 weeks ago, again, polls came out indicating that the Minister of Health, appointed by Bolsonaro, and up until late February was someone that you basically no one took any notice, but he was a doctor by trade. And he started a very serious approach of, first of all, during a pandemic, we need to have transparency. And we need to have a one single coherent voice regarding in terms of policy. So once again, daily going press conference, releasing data, talking about the need for social distancing, isolations, and things like that. And a poll came out placing the Minister of Health, his last name is Mandetta, with approving rates of approximately 86% against 42 of Bolsonaro. And almost immediately reacted because starting to perceive Mandetta as a possible opponent as well. So Brazil suffered through 2 weeks of intense friction. We have a word in Portuguese to describe this process. It's called deep fry. When a politician, he wants to get rid of someone, but on the formal firing would be very high cost, a political cost. So a process of deep fry, trying daily to undermine, to downplay whatever this official says. So the Minister of Health went through 2 weeks of deep fry in open public, to make it so that the situation was so unlivable, impossible, that he would ask to resign. But he, and then there was one magnificent quote by him when asked by a reporter in a press conference if he was going to resign, saying, "I'm first a doctor. A doctor does not leave abandon its patient." 3 hours later, Bolsonaro tweeted, "Yeah, but a patient is able to ask for another doctor, so I'm going to fire you." And he was fired the next day.
Okay.
So,
you know, what's striking about this, about what you have just described, is it sure sounds like what Brazil is rather similar to the U.S., but Bolsonaro is known as the Trump of the tropics up here in the U.S., I want to thank you for your updates, and certainly something that we're going to be watching. So perhaps we can learn from Brazil's experience, and certainly because of the role that the pandemic is playing in political issues. So thank you very much, Erica Resende.
Welcome, welcome. And anytime you want to have a chat, you know how to reach me. Stay healthy, stay at home.
So we discussed the current status of the COVID-19 pandemic in Brazil with Erica Resende. She is an assistant professor of international relations and security studies at the Brazilian War College in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. She is the co-editor of Memory and Trauma in International Relations, Theories, Cases and Debates, and Crisis and Change in Post-Cold War Global Politics. Thank you very much.
When we come back, how the novel coronavirus is affecting young people, children, and adolescents, and how we can support them. Stay tuned. Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, what are the psychological challenges for children and young people amidst this time of COVID-19? Contributing host Lillian Ng speaks with Hiren Tabru and Melanie Woodfield about the ways that families can support their children and adolescents.
What psychological challenges do children and young people face amidst COVID-19? To explore this question, I'm joined by Hiren Tabru and Melanie Woodfield. Hiren is a pediatrician and child and adolescent psychiatrist with research interests in e-health. And Melanie Woodfield is a clinical psychologist and researcher in parent well-being and child conduct problems. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Looking through a child's lens, how might they be viewing the world at this very strange time?
It is a strange time, and I think one of the areas in which it's strange is that when small children think about threats are usually obvious and tangible, and I mean, you think of tigers and ghosts and baddies, And just out of interest, that's one of the reasons why we need quite nuanced and sophisticated teaching around stranger danger. I think one of the challenges for young children at this time is that the threat that we're facing is intangible, it's invisible. And for small children who struggle with abstract reasoning, with kind of making sense of things that they can't necessarily see or hear, some of the things that we're being asked to do don't make a lot of sense. We're being asked to wash our hands to keep ourselves safe, or to stay away from grandma to keep her safe. I mean, those things really don't make sense to a young child. And at a very practical level, there have been lots of changes for small children. You know, schools closed, kindies closed, no more play dates, playground trips. And parents are in a different space than they used to be. They might be physically present more often, but maybe a bit preoccupied or perhaps less emotionally available.
What about young people who are facing disruption to their social networks, to their group activities, to schooling? How might this affect their development?
Yeah, one of the things I think we need to remember is that school is much, much more than just academic learning. It's almost a microcosm of society for adolescents. And in some very practical ways, it's important. We know that schools are often one of the first places that adolescents seek help. Schools are very common referrers to community-based mental health services for adolescents, for example. There are often good relationships between young people and teaching staff and deans and guidance staff at schools. So there's that very practical consideration, but also the social isolation of not being at school, particularly in a season for adolescents where identity formation is happening. They're figuring out who they are, and that process normally happens in relationship with others. And look, we've heard some high-profile psychologists in the media reassuring us that getting a PhD or not won't come down to the couple of weeks of lost schooling in the midst of the pandemic. And I agree with that. But I do think it's important that we remember that young people have a variety of needs that aren't necessarily just academic.
Can you talk a little bit more about some of those needs and how that might play out in the home when young people and children are observing their parents?
It's hard. I mean, I don't know about others, but certainly I think we can struggle to, there's such variety of where young people are at and such differences in their family circumstances. We have the great digital divide, for example. You know, some young people remain very connected socially despite being at home, whereas others won't. We have some young people in overcrowded situations at home where it's difficult to get privacy so that you can connect with your best friend or your partner. And some young people will be having to pick up some caretaking roles for younger siblings or for older family members while mums, dads, parents are working in the home, for example.
So how can families help children and young people get through this time?
I think there's a few things that families can certainly do. The first is to keep regular routines and schedules as much as possible, or create new ones in a new environment like your bubble, and make sure that you include time for learning, but also time for playing and time for relaxing. These routines do offer structure and predictability and make children feel safe. The second thing, which might be easier said than done, is to stay as calm as possible yourself under the circumstances and given the uncertainties, and try to discuss your own worries with other adults away from children as much as possible. Limiting the amount of time you spend talking about COVID-19 in particular and watching the news or checking information online can also be useful for yourself to ameliorate your own anxiety, but also kind of to reduce the amount of time that your children and young people have spent focusing on that as well. As Mel has indicated, I think children can be a bit confused by some of the instructions right now, but some of them can also be helpful. Certainly giving your children specific things that they can do to feel in control, like washing their hands, eating well to stay healthy, getting lots of sleep, and doing nice things for others, especially grandparents that they may not be able to see for a while, like making cards or sort of sending e-messages, e-video messages, can be very helpful. As long as they understand why they need to do the things they're being asked to do, they'll probably appreciate that. I think being a good role model is also really important. So if you're asking your kids to wash their hands, then make sure that they see you doing that as well. If you're asking them to kind of look after their mental health and relax, then it's important that you do the same. And it's if you model how you use a menu of self-care activities, such as taking regular walks and breaks for reading or talking with friends, and they're more likely to copy you than to listen to what you say. There's a number of e-health interventions as well. This is one of my areas of interest, so I'll talk a bit about this, that are also out there from youth-oriented tools like Aroha, which is a new chatbot designed at Auckland University, to adult-oriented relaxation apps like Calm and Breathe that can also be used very easily by adolescents.
Can you tell us a little bit more about Aroha, the chatbot?
So Aroha was designed at the University of Auckland by the eHealth team and the Department of Psychological Medicine. And it's a chatbot that helps young people identify the type of feelings that they're having and the type of worries particularly, and also learn a new set of coping strategies for dealing with particularly COVID-19 related anxiety. It's brand new. It's been co-designed with young people from New Zealand, including those of Māori and Pacific ethnicity. And it's we're really excited to kind of see it launched in the last week or so, and hoping that it will be used by a lot of young people around the country.
The family bubble is very important at the moment. So what should parents say to children and young people who may feel very worried about what's happening in the world at the moment?
Yeah, there's certainly a number of kids who are going to be in this situation at the moment. The first thing to do is to find out what kids actually know in an age-appropriate way. So if they're really young, you could just ask in more general terms about whether they've heard grown-ups talking about a new illness, or older children could be asked more specifically, you know, if they've heard so-and-so talking about COVID or coronavirus. Find out how they obtain the information in case you need to manage any particularly unhelpful sources of information. The key message when it comes to talking about kids about difficult things like this is to follow their lead. Some kids want to spend a lot of time talking and others don't want to talk at all. The ones who don't will usually ask more when they're ready, or they might ask for information in bite-sized chunks as you go along or while you're doing other activities. Just use the opportunities to tell them what they need to know to the extent that they want to. But if you tell them more than they need to, it might just worry them. When you're answering questions, try and be as honest as comforting and use age-appropriate language as much as possible. Try not to give them false reassurance, because kids can usually tell when you're lying. And so if you don't know the answer to a question, say you don't know and use the opportunity to find out together using a reliable internet resource. But talk to them about all the things that are happening to keep people safe and healthy in hospitals and the community, and also things that they can do at home. It's good to talk about COVID and what's happening for about 5 minutes a day, certainly have a regular check-in time. But I wouldn't say that it's useful to kind of keep talking about it all through the day, as this just maintains any anxiety that might already be there. But if you notice that despite doing the things I've said, your kids are still having difficulty, they're overtly anxious, they're having difficulty with their eating or their sleep or their concentration, or they start to act out. And particularly this might include something we call regression, where kids go back to doing things that they've outgrown, like wetting the bed or sleepwalking or having nightmares, then you might want to get some help from your local child and adolescent mental health service.
What other psychological issues might arise from this quarantine period? We're amidst it, but as we emerge from quarantine, there are likely to be some additional difficulties.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the short answer, which is very unsatisfactory, but the short answer is we actually just don't know. I mean, this situation is really unprecedented. That word has been used so often in this season, but we just don't know. I know there's a really recent Lancet paper that I was quite interested in that came out just a wee while ago, and it was sort of a call for action for mental health science in terms of, and it was an interdisciplinary group of experts saying we really need to get ready to get stuck in terms of researching what the effects of this pandemic have been on our emotional well-being. So the short answer is we don't know. What I would say to parents listening is that there's a really wide range of normal, and that, as Haran said, things like developmental regression are actually really common, and in many, many cases will be just a normal reflection of the unsettled season that we've had. So I think people don't necessarily need to panic if their child has started to bedwet again, or has been a bit more clingy, or a few more meltdowns, to just see that as quite a probably a normal part of the adjustment process. So a wide range of normal. Some children will be really vocal and verbal about their distress and their concern. Some children are very sensitive. Other children might actually be quite quiet and sort of solemn, but might actually be doing okay. So it's really hard to say what the psychological issues may be. Most people are saying that we're likely to see a rise in anxiety, possibly specifically PTSD. But the short answer, which, as I say, is really unsatisfactory, is we really don't know yet.
How can we encourage children and young people to express themselves or help them process their emotions, particularly when they're not inclined to articulate them?
Children deal with things in different ways, depending on their developmental stage and age, but also on their individual personalities. I think for most parents, if you've got adolescents, you know there comes a time when you stop talking to them face to face because they'll just say nah or dunno to every question. And you're better off just to have the conversation in the car, like when you're side by side. So all kids are different and they go through different stages where they'll respond to information in different ways. So as I said before, follow their lead, tell them, find out what they know, tell them as much as they want to know, and be prepared to come back to information and repeat it a number of times in layers until they understand enough.
You mentioned children picking up on parents' stress, and children and young people are observing their parents and likely seeing a high level of preoccupation. What advice do you have for parents and caregivers about how they can manage their own worries?
Well, I think there's a number of things parents can do. You're absolutely right. They are as important to kind of children's mental health as the things that children will be doing directly. The first thing is acknowledge that what's going on is real and that it is weird and unprecedented, as Mel has said, and that so might your feelings about it be. It can be useful to try and figure out how you're feeling and kind of name the feelings, whether it's worry or anxiety, and also try and develop some system for keeping an eye on them. So some people find that having a rating out of 10, just to know I'm anxious and I feel like a 9, is quite helpful. For other people, it could just be like a traffic light system. I'm a red right now. I need to kind of stop and do something about this. Try and devise some kind of system for yourself and just check in with yourself once a day as well, just to see how you've been in the last day, because that will give you an idea about what you might need to do. If you're feeling fine, if your number's on the low side, if you're in the green zone, then you may just be able to carry on. If you're sort of amber or kind of your number's in the middle, you might need to actually slow down for a bit. And if you're red or your number's high, you might need to actually just say, I think I need to pause. I need to kind of put a few things I was going to do today on hold and do some self-care and then come back to them. There's no magic answer to how to cope. Different people do things in different ways. So try and find out kind of what works for you. You might have some clues from things that have happened to you in the past as to kind of your favorite coping strategies. Going for a run, reading a book, talking to friends. But if these were not so healthy ones, like drinking alcohol or using substances, then try and avoid doing these again. Once you've developed a menu of self-care strategies, make sure you use them. Try and limit the amount of time you spent on social media, especially looking up stories about COVID-19. It can really be hard, but if you just try, maybe even just checking Facebook a couple of times in the next day rather than 10 times a day, see what difference that makes.
We live within a multicultural society, and sometimes our young people are confronted by really difficult topics like racism, which seems to be an additional issue at the moment. What advice do you have for parents about talking about it with their children?
It's definitely an issue at the moment in New Zealand, but also in many parts of the world. As people are scared, it's useful to kind of want to blame other people and pick on particular cultures or races. The first thing to say is to try and model compassion and non-racist, non-stigmatizing speech yourself. So try not to stereotype people in countries when you're talking with your kids or with other adults. Talk about people who get or acquire the virus rather than those who transmit or spread it. And try not to talk about things like plagues or apocalypse. Provide accurate information about COVID-19 and explain that even though it originated from a geographical area in China, viruses don't recognize race, ethnicity, or nationality. And then if there has been any harassment or bullying that your child describes, you need to address it. If they've said or done something, you need to let them know it's not okay. And if they've witnessed something like that between friends, then talk about how they can deal with it if it happens again. if they've been the victim, and particularly if they're upset by it, you might need to make a plan of how to deal with that with them and also with others like their friends or people at school once school starts again. One of the things about these kind of issues is that they can be opportunities as well to educate kids about racism and discrimination. So you can do this in many ways by emphasizing positive familiar individuals from different groups, identifying heroes from different cultural backgrounds. For older kids, reading books or watching movies that kind of address racial intolerance, prejudice, racism and hatred. There's many ways in which you can get your kids to learn a lot about the world and what's right and wrong through a time like this.
How can families support the young people to feel safe and connected?
Kids feel contained, they feel secure when things are predictable and familiar. I guess some practical things, trying to keep the family routine the same around bedtimes, meal times, and other sort of rhythms of daily life. I prefer to talk about rhythms than routines. And even for adolescents, you know, not necessarily allowing limitless time on screens if you wouldn't normally, having some firm but warm limits and boundaries is actually really containing for young people and children. I think it's tempting to think, oh, this is such a difficult time for us all, let's just go with the flow and not have any sort of boundaries or limits. But maybe paradoxically, children actually thrive with limits and boundaries that are warm and that are fair. The reality is many of us are juggling work expectations, we're juggling our own well-being, our own stress, our own fears for the future. And I think it's important that parents don't beat themselves up if there are times when they're tearful in front of the children or have watched the news for 5 minutes when they know they probably should turn it off or something like that. I think it's important to just acknowledge that we are human, we are not robots, and that sometimes things will happen that in the ideal world we know we probably wouldn't have done. What I would say is it's really useful to debrief those situations with kids. So if you've been a bit snappy with your partner, for example, it's useful to sort of resolve the conflict, if you like, and not leave it unresolved. So, you know, I'm feeling a bit stressed at the moment, and that means that I was a bit more snappy than I usually am, and maybe you're feeling a bit stressed as well. With really young kids, kids under about 6, they tend to be what we call developmentally egocentric. So they tend to attribute parents sort of emotional state changes to their own behaviour, their own actions. So if mum has tears in her eyes, the 4-year-old or 5-year-old might be inclined to think it's because of something that they did. And as we know, 9 times out of 10, it's not. So it's really useful to say to kids, I'm upset because I'm thinking about grandma and I really miss her. So I guess just some practical considerations for the younger kids there.
Do you have any specific advice about frequency and access to technology? Just aware that quite a lot of our young people are accessing social media, and it may be sometimes unsupervised due to parental commitments and preoccupation.
There are things online that are helpful and supportive and connective, and there are things online that are less helpful. And as Haran was saying, sometimes it's about the frequency, it's about what they're accessing, how often they're accessing it, and whether that is fostering well-being. If we think about what young people need, they need connectedness, they need so some of the online gaming can provide that, for example, but sometimes it doesn't. So I struggle to provide a blanket sort of set of guidance there. I think it will be quite specific to each family's circumstance, but maybe just step back and think, what is this online activity providing for my child or for my young person?
Yeah, I'd echo a lot of those sentiments because, I mean, I think young people these days particularly are living in a much more connected world, and they are digital natives. They're not growing up like we grew up with books and, you know, television and black and white or colour or whatever. So they are going to be much more familiar with it. And now even in school, they're going to be encouraged to use technology kind of to learn as well a lot more now immediately, especially, but also going forward. There was a BNZ ad a few years ago, some of you may remember, which sort of said money, it's not good, it's not bad, it's what you do with it. And I feel the same is true for technology. It's here to stay with us, and we need to find more ways of using it in a helpful way than in an unhelpful way.
I mean, there are some unhelpful forums out there, and young people may be cyberbullied. So is that a particular issue of concern as we emerge from COVID-19, where they've been spending a lot of time online together, and it may be more prominent?
Yeah, I think cyberbullying is definitely an increasing issue and one we're becoming more aware of. However, there's face-to-face bullying hasn't gone away despite cyberbullying increasing. Obviously, with kids being more at home and being less at school, there's been less of the face-to-face bullying. So relatively, it's possible that cyberbullying might have gone up. I think, once again, young people being on sites where they're unsupervised and getting into dangerous kind of agreements and arrangements with friends in an inadequately supervised manner is what is more likely to make it more likely to happen. If it does happen, I suppose the important thing for young people is that they can reach out to their parents, that they know they've got an open door there, that they won't be judged, that they can actually go to them and talk about what's happened and get some help about how to deal with it. So make sure that you do leave that door open for young people. You can't monitor everything they're doing. It's physically impossible. You can only set them up with the ground rules and the education about how to use their technology in the right way. But if they're not using them, if that doesn't happen, or anything happens to them despite them doing the right thing, especially cyberbullying, then let them know that it's important that they come to you.
Are there any particular groups of children or young people who are more likely to be at risk of psychological problems?
Children with pre-existing psychological issues, particularly anxiety and depression, may be more vulnerable to an increase in symptoms during lockdown or in the months afterwards, especially if family finances are limited, if parents become unemployed, if sort of family stress increases. So they'd be one group to watch out for. Another couple of groups are young people from Maori and Pacific Island backgrounds and those with long-term physical conditions who historically have had sort of increased rates of anxiety, depression, mental health problems. One might think that they might be more vulnerable under these situations. However, just I'd like to make it clear that there's no clear evidence that they actually fare worse during crises such as pandemics. Time may tell. More clearly, children of essential workers are likely to be facing additional dilemmas at the moment. Many of them will be missing their parents who are at work. They'll be worrying about whether they're safe or not. And they'll also be worrying about catching COVID-19 from their parents when they return home. So these worries are probably balanced out by, for the majority of children, having greater access to their parents, having less academic and social demands, having sort of, you know, flexible but clear routines at home and regular opportunities to connect with family and friends. So it's quite possible that for some of them, they might actually be doing better during this period of isolation or lockdown where they have more family support and connection. For some, it might not be being in isolation, but it might be returning to school and back to normal routines. That's more challenging. But fortunately, most parents know how to manage these times from the experience of getting back to regular routines, say, after long school holidays. So I'd just advise that they reuse effective strategies to manage these transitions.
A lot of the focus at the moment is on protecting and promoting psychological well-being, as well as preventing mental health conditions from emerging. And I think parents doing a lot at the moment, they're teaching, working, parenting, working remotely, they're trying to keep their children busy and safe at home, and it's quite a daunting prospect. Do you have any final reflections on what can be done to support parents at this time?
I just come back to that parents are not robots. It's not about learning more, doing more. That's a common theme that I've observed, is that parents feel compelled to just do more, do more, do more, to, you know, digest the 20 emails a day that arrive from the child's school, to become an expert in homeschooling overnight, to, you know, continue to perform at the pre-pandemic level in terms of working from home. And this is a lot, and in many cases overwhelming, especially where parents already might have struggled with big emotions, might have struggled with sadness, with stress, with anxiety, with kind of big feelings that got in the way. It sounds so trite, but I really think it's important, you know, in the airplane, the air hostess says, put your own oxygen mask on first before you see to your children. often parents won't do that in practical ways at home because it feels selfish, or it feels, oh, I should put my child's needs first. But actually, looking after your own needs is really, really important. Parenting effectively is not just about knowledge and skills. It's actually being about being able to connect with that knowledge and skill through being well yourself. So whatever that looks like for you as a parent, it'll look different for everyone. It's really important to top up your own tank, whether that's getting out and going for a walk, and to not feel bad or guilty about doing that. That will actually restore your ability to continue to meet your child's needs. It is a really tough time. We have to acknowledge that, and we have to be kind to ourselves.
I completely agree with being kind to yourself. I think it's so important. And I think that, you know, for your kids to see you doing that, to actually model those things that you're talking about, to actually use every opportunity, which doesn't go so well, to kind of, you know, do a bit of reflection, do a bit of learning, to show them that, you know, this is being human. This is being real. Being your best is actually about being human under all circumstances, not trying to be perfect in some artificial way, but, you know, to kind of balance all those different tasks and responsibilities that we have, and also look after ourselves through that process. I think there are some opportunities at this time, but for sure, a lot of parents are going to have found a lot of extra work over the last few weeks because of the demands of the workplace. Now that things like Zoom and technology are so easily available, well, why can't we be there? But it doesn't mean that we have the mental space to kind of do all of that and all the extra as well. So we would have already been prioritizing what we can do, what we can leave till later. And I think we need to practice doing that for a lot longer, because it's not just what's happening at the moment. It's also coming out of lockdown and the uncertainty about how long this is going to last, whether this is going to be a month, whether we're going to go in and out of different phases of lockdown. We need to be prepared for a bit of a roller coaster and kind of remember that this is a marathon and not a sprint.
So thank you to Harantha Brew and Melanie Woodfield for helping me explore this question about what psychological challenges children and young people face amidst this time of COVID-19. And thank you to our audience for listening.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.